Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's Friday the 13th of May, and this is the Takeaway Podcast.
I was very encouraged with this meeting, but this is a process.
My father's built an enormous business. And truthfully, you can't function in business if you can't get along with people.
Cordial meeting to discuss the way forward. We know the alternative is 4 more years, just like the last 8.
You don't put it together in 45 minutes.
I kind of like to be the president. Yeah. So I can show you how your money.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And what a day yesterday. The Republican leadership all over Washington, D.C., opening their doors to Donald Trump. He was like some villain in a superhero movie, trailed by the cops and the media as he dictated his terms for saving the city. The leaders, Republican leaders in this case, were encouraged. They seemed to be slowly jumping on the Trump bandwagon. Did Trump give anything up? Did Donald Trump make any big concessions? Didn't really seem like it.
I don't like talking so specifically. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that like a fool. I'm going to do this, this, this. I want them to understand. I want to be unpredictable.
But there are places in Washington, D.C. that wonder about this joker, let's call him, who would be president. Embassies talking to their governments overseas about who this guy is. Can we work with him? Should we be worried? I don't know. Should they be worried? Is Donald Trump a joker or the Joker?
I don't like talking so specifically.
Do I really look like a guy with a plan? You know what I am? I'm a dog chasing cars. I wouldn't know what to do with one if I caught it. You know, I just do things.
I'm going to do this, this, this.
I'm not a schemer. I try to show the schemers how pathetic their attempts to control things really are.
I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that like a fool.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
I want them to understand.
Introduce a little anarchy. Upset the established order, and everything becomes chaos.
I want to be unpredictable.
He wants to be unpredictable. But is Donald Trump an agent of chaos? That's among the questions they're asking in foreign embassies and foreign capitals as Donald Trump slowly mends his fences with Republicans here in the U.S. in time for a chummy convention in Cleveland this summer. Well, our Dark Knight Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick has been going around Washington, D.C., talking to foreign policy experts and various diplomats to find out if they are fine with all this or making evacuation plans. Todd?
Hi, John. That's right. I've been going around town talking to a lot of people involved in diplomacy in Washington, D.C., because there's a lot of confusion about contradictory statements that Donald Trump has made about NATO or different parts of the world. But when Republican national security establishment figures, long well-known advisors, stepped away from Donald Trump, foreign governments started to wonder, who's advising him? Who's he talking to? How do we know what this guy is really about?
All right, Todd, so let's roll out the map here and figure out where the worry centers in the world are about Donald Trump. Let's start with Europe, NATO, and Russia.
NATO is obsolete. NATO has to either be rejiggered, rechanged, you know, changed for the better. I'm not saying the other thing that's bad about NATO, we're paying too much. We're spending a tremendous billions and billions of dollars on NATO.
Now, I talked to former NATO Ambassador Kurt Volker here in Washington, and interestingly, he told me that Donald Trump's rhetoric about getting NATO countries, Germany, France, Britain, and the rest, to pay more for their NATO membership and for their militaries doesn't really concern people all that much. They don't like it, but they've heard this song before from a lot of U.S. presidents. In fact, they heard it from Barack Obama. He made the British pony up and pay more, and David Cameron agreed to do it. That doesn't really worry them so much. What worries them is Donald Trump's cozy relationship with Vladimir Putin, and especially the Eastern European countries, NATO allies in the Baltics like Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, and non-NATO countries in Eastern Europe. John, why? They are starting to get extremely worried that Donald Trump could go right over their heads and cut a deal with Vladimir Putin. Now, I asked Kimberly Martin about this. She's on The Takeaway all the time, friend of the show, of course. She's a Russia analyst and professor at Barnard College.
It's because of who Trump has chosen as his advisors. One of his advisors is Paul Manafort, who was the advisor to the deposed Ukrainian president, Yanukovych. And another advisor, apparently his chief Russia advisor, is a man named Carter Page, who has made his career as an investor and advisor to Gazprom, the Russian state gas company. So, of course, the Russians are very happy about the prospect that Trump might be president.
So Trump and Putin can work together, and Putin has certainly suggested that he has no problem with Donald Trump. And, of course, that would rattle the nerves in NATO. Absolutely. What about in Asia, Korea, Japan?
At some point, we have to say, you know what? We're better off if Japan protects itself against this maniac in North Korea. We're better off, frankly, if South Korea is going to start to protect itself.
Saudi Arabia, nuclear weapons?
Saudi Arabia, absolutely.
Well, John, here a lot of the concerns are much, much more serious. The United States has military cooperation treaties with Japan and South Korea, with Japan going back to 1951 and with South Korea going all the way back to 1953. And one thing that analysts and experts on Japan and South Korea told me about Donald Trump's campaign statements is that it makes them extremely nervous. The South Koreans have been desperately trying to find out in Washington what Donald Trump really means. They don't know who to talk to, so they went to Senator Jeff Sessions, the Republican of Alabama, the Donald Trump whisperer, the advisor, the one who's sort of Donald Trump's liaison to Congress. And I went and asked Jeff Sessions about the South Koreans' concerns.
I have met with a number of people. Yeah, so I think that's a good alliance we've had. There's no doubt, but I think he will rightly push them to participate more in their defense, in our mutual defense. The United States economy is not so great that we can finance the entire security of the free world.
Sounds like Sessions is saying it's a new world, tough bananas, guys.
He kind of is saying that. He's saying he has met with nervous South Koreans, and if Donald Trump is president, this is the way it might be.
But it might be in China's interest to have all of this uncertainty and to have, as you say, South Koreans getting close to freaking out. What do they say in China as we move across the map?
John, the Chinese case is really interesting, and I found it counterintuitive, especially when you take in and absorb some of the things that Donald Trump loves to say on the campaign trail about China.
We can't continue to allow China to rape our country, and that's what they're doing. It's the greatest theft in the history of the world.
Now, John, if you heard that and you were a Chinese diplomat or an official or even a Chinese minister of trade, you might think that they are scared to death about the prospects of a Donald Trump presidency, that they might think economically, militarily, strategically, he's coming for their heads. It's not the case. I spoke to Dennis Wilder. He's a former member of the National Security Council in the Bush administration and a China-Japan expert. He told me that, in fact, the Chinese have a name for Donald Trump. It's Big Gun or even Big Mouth. They think that Donald Trump talks a big game, but that he's a businessman. He's a transactionalist. They've dealt with businessmen like this for 30 years in America, and they feel like they can really deal with Donald Trump. He's a known quantity. He may be bombastic, but he knows how to make a deal, and so do they. And China, according to Dennis Wilder, is pretty comfortable with Donald Trump. But John, the person they're not comfortable with, that they're a little afraid of, is the woman they call the Iron Lady.
If there is one message that echoes forth from this conference, let it be that human rights are women's rights, and women's rights are human rights once and for all.
Hillary Clinton went to that big showcase conference 20 years ago in Beijing. That speech she gave, women's rights are human rights, that embarrassed the Chinese. That showed them up in front of the world, and they never forgot it. But here's something that's maybe even more important. 2010, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went to Hanoi and announced the Obama administration's tilt toward Asia, and she talked tough about Chinese involvement in the South China Sea.
The United States does not take a position on competing territorial claims, but we believe the nations of the region should work collaboratively together to resolve disputes without coercion, without intimidation, without threats, and certainly without the use of force.
So spinning the globe and coming back to the Western Hemisphere, I got to figure the folks in Mexico are, if not worried, they're angry about the prospect of Donald Trump making it into the White House.
Well, there is just no way that Mexico and Mexican diplomats like what they're hearing out of Donald Trump in this campaign. I talked to Tony Wayne. He's the former U.S. ambassador to Mexico up until just a couple of months ago. He was in Mexico City for the State Department for 4 years.
But I think this time there has been some rhetoric and some factual misrepresentation from a Mexican perspective that has been particularly disturbing to many Mexicans, because there's a sense that it doesn't accurately portray either Mexico or the quality of the U.S.-Mexico relationship.
And in the case of Mexico, they're in a position to actually influence voters in the United States in a way that other nations aren't, right?
And Mexico desperately wants to influence American voters, not telling them how to vote, but in reminding them about the gigantic $600 billion trade relationship between the United States and Mexico, that Mexico is the U.S.'s number two trading partner, and that there are millions of jobs at stake. That's what Mexico wants to do. Look, in truth, the Mexicans aren't really worried too much about rhetoric about building the wall higher or making the wall greater or even having the Mexicans pay for it. What they're worried about is whether the American population will get to a place where it doesn't want to deal with Mexico anymore in the same way. Duncan Wood is head of the Mexico section at the Wilson Center, and I sat down with him too.
So what people in Mexico in positions of influence, both in the private sector and in the public sector, are looking for right now is to say, how deep does this go? How much of a challenge is it?
So the real question is not, is Donald Trump a joker or an ugly American? But is this ugly American moment that they're seeing in the campaign, does it go deep into the American electorate? And if that's the case, it's worrisome indeed.
John, as I talked to all these people around Washington, one thing was pretty clear, at least as far as other governments are concerned. Our allies and friends are either confused or a little bit worried about what a Trump presidency might look like. Adversaries like Russia and China, on the other hand, may be mostly pleased by a Trump presidency, someone they can cut advantageous deals with, while the one they fear is the Iron Lady, Hillary Clinton.
Takeaway Washington correspondent, our dark night in Washington, D.C., Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much, Todd.
You got it, John.
Every year around this time, tens of thousands of law enforcement officers from across the country gather for a memorial in Washington, D.C. in a week of meetings, bonding, and general all-around solidarity. FBI Director James Comey delivered a video message for the officers coming this year and the 137 officers, deputies, and agents killed on the job in 2015.
These tragedies remind us that our safety and our freedoms, which we hold so dear, are purchased at great cost.
It's National Police Week. And is this an appropriate outlook for law enforcement? Certainly no one would begrudge them a week of R&R in the nation's capital. But are police officers a separate team from the citizens they protect? Is a circling the wagon, us versus them culture of policing compounding the problems today? FBI Director Comey this week addressed one of those problems across the country by referencing what he called a viral video effect that may be at the heart of a spike in homicides across the country since January.
Director Comey can't overlook the possibility that perhaps it's poor management in police departments. Perhaps officers are being told to pull back. We've heard that from a number of quarters, that officers are being told to stand down. And this certainly is as much a possibility as his totally unfounded assertion.
That's James Pascoe, Jr., Executive Director of the National Fraternal Order of Police. Can it be said that viral videos are the problem and that the cost of a new accountability by police officers to their citizens is a fall off in tough crime enforcement? Do we accept that or call it a form of extortion? You prosecute us for brutality, we will relax or hesitate in our enforcement of violent crime. Well, of course, no one is saying that. But Jeff Asher, a crime analyst based in New Orleans, has recently taken a look and found both a surprising jump in murder rates over the winter and a decrease in arrests following the police killings of civilians in Chicago. Is there a viral video mentality? Citizen videos have revealed brutal and deadly policing tactics. Just over a year ago, Freddie Gray, his arrest caught on a cell phone camera, led to outrage and months of protests in Baltimore. DeRay McKesson, activist and former candidate for mayor in Baltimore, joins us now. DeRay McKesson, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, it's good to be here.
So to both of you, is there a general way in which these police murders of the last year or two have created an overall change in the environment for law enforcement and for civilians? Jeff?
It's a localized effect is what we're seeing. I don't think it's some sort of nationwide effect sweeping the country.
DeRay McKesson, what do you think? Localized or a sea change in individual communities?
I think it's a both and, not an either or. What we do see is more scrutiny to the police across the country. What we haven't seen, though, is any causation between police accountability and any spike in crime or arrests or violence in communities.
Jeff Asher, is the Chicago situation and the data you found in Chicago, does it support this idea of police maybe, you know, backing off as a way of responding to the viral video mentality that Director Comey is talking about?
Well, something definitely changed in Chicago, and we were able to correlate it chronologically very closely with the release of the Laquan McDonald video in November of last year. And it's not just that gun violence went up right after the video was released at a time when traditionally we would expect gun violence to be going down as the Chicago winter sets in. In addition, arrests went down significantly, but also a lot of the measures of proactive policing. Rob Arthur and I, in our 538 article, brought up drug violations as a measure of proactive policing. And December of 2015 saw the largest decrease from 1 month to the next in terms of drug violations in the previous 10 plus years in Chicago.
Although here is a, quite frankly, bitter sounding response from James Pasco Jr., the executive director of the National Fraternal Order of Police.
You know, it's possible that police officers are doing the job to the best of their ability every single day, risking their lives out there to keep America as safe as possible, given the poverty and the failed economy and the failed educational system and the rotting infrastructure that people are forced to live within.
DeRay McKesson, what concerns me about what Pasco is saying there and all of this is that it's possible that police and the civilian world are responding to everything that's happened since 2014 in very different ways. In other words, we're not finding common ground. We're finding separate tents to go under. Do you feel that?
I think the public has been incredibly open to having a conversation about what should change. I have not seen police departments around the country actually be as open to talk about and acknowledge that there's something with the policing culture that is problematic. I think that Pasco's comments actually highlight the problematic nature when he is suggesting that this is just as good as it can get. That, like, if Laquan McDonald is a casualty of good policing, how he defines it, then that just is what it is. And I think that's really dangerous. And Asher's research, I think, is interesting. I think that we should continue to ask these questions to get to why. I want to be careful, though, to note that there's nobody saying that this is causation, that he is saying that there seems to be correlation and this could be one answer, but in no way is that definitive. I think the data set is actually not large enough to say anything conclusive.
Jeff Asher, is it possible that FBI Director Comey's remark, viral video effect, may conceal some pattern that they're seeing in the FBI data? Because they do have a huge amount of crime stats.
The way that crime data is collected and organized and distributed in this country makes answering that question virtually impossible. It won't be until September of 2016 until we'll actually see the FBI's 2015 data. There's no way of really knowing whether or not the FBI has data about 2016 trends that we're unable to decipher, unable to analyze. All of the open crime data that's available right now provides us some glimpse into what is happening in 2016. And it doesn't suggest that there's been some sort of national sea change.
So that suggests, DeRay, that you know, what Comey is saying borders on irresponsible. I mean, he's talking about stuff that he may or may not have information on, but he makes this blanket statement that suggests that law enforcement isn't interested in accountability.
So he continues to make it, and that's actually what's most problematic, is that President Obama, Attorney General Loretta Lynch, they have distanced themselves from ever making these statements in public. They don't make them. They talk about this data, and they talk about what's happening in these three cities specifically with much more nuance. And Comey has been dogmatic about suggesting that the Ferguson effect is real. And recently he's saying he's not calling it the Ferguson effect, but he is essentially saying the exact same thing. And that's a real problem. But when we think about a whole culture change, that this has to be deeply rooted and systemic. And we've just not seen police officers or police chiefs publicly rally around that. And that has to be a part of the work. And Comey's statements don't encourage collaboration. They continue to encourage this friction, especially because it's not based in facts.
DeRay McKesson is an activist and former candidate for mayor in the city of Baltimore. Jeff Asher is a crime analyst based in New Orleans who's written for 538. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
DeRay, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And on this Friday the 13th, how worried are you about this Friday the 13th? It's already started. Your luck's been pretty good so far. But you may want to find a bunker with a TV just to be safe. Hide yourself away till everything's better. What should we take into our Friday the 13th bunkers, folks, huh? Well, Melissa Locker, who's written for The Guardian and Time, says to keep up your spirits, you should get the new Netflix comedy special from Ali Wong called Baby Cobra.
She's one of the first female comedians, maybe the only ever female comedian, to do an entire comedy special while 7 months pregnant.
I've heard about this. I've heard that she's fantastic. What do we love about her?
She's hilarious. She's raunchy. She's not for everyone, but she is definitely incredibly fun to listen to.
It's very rare and unusual to see a female comic perform pregnant because female comics don't get pregnant. Just try to think of one. I dare you. There's none of them. Once they do get pregnant, they generally disappear.
The kind of the punchline to every joke is that she is 7 months pregnant. And so she can say the raunchiest, dirtiest things. And then you just look at her and you start laughing because she's this incredibly cute woman with this enormous stomach sticking off of her. And she's talking about, you know, the struggles of going to the bathroom at work or, you know, trying to trap her Harvard Business School husband. And it's hilarious.
And a fresh alternative to Amy Schumer.
Absolutely. She's pretty different from Amy Schumer because she does spend a lot of the time talking about how she just wants to be a stay-at-home mom. Like, she wants to stop working and she just wants to live the dream. I think a lot of it's a joke because she's a very successful writer. She works on Fresh Off the Boat. She has an incredible career. So I think some of it's tongue-in-cheek, but it might not be.
All right, well, it's a great idea. And this is a Netflix comedy special.
This is on Netflix. It probably pops up on your the second you log into Netflix saying, watch Ali Wong. And you should.
And it's the season for Eurovision.
It is. And for the first time in the show's 61-year history, it is actually being broadcast in the United States.
What is Eurovision? How do we understand Eurovision? How do you understand your love of Eurovision?
If you like American Idol, if you like The Voice, or even if you hate American Idol and hate The Voice, you're probably still going to love Eurovision. It is the biggest, campiest, silliest song competition in Europe. I think it's over 40 countries send singers to go try and represent their country with the corniest, campiest song that they can come up with. I mean, they're not supposed to be corny campy, but they are.
Oh, well, I love Eurovision. When I lived out of the United States, I mean, it was an absolute obsession everywhere I lived. Here's the Russian finalist.
You're the only one.
That is so Eurovision.
This guy is a front runner. A lot of people are expecting him to take the entire competition. Russia came in second last year. They were beat by Sweden, who's hosting the competition this year. So a lot of people think Russia is in the lead this year. And can you argue with this?
Let's listen to Sergei Lazarev.
My love is rising, the story's unwinding. Together we'll make it and reach for the stars.
Oh, you can feel the tanks rolling into Ukraine.
Right, and if you do get a chance to either log onto the web or to watch on Logo, the costumes are absolutely, they're like three quarters of the show.
Glitter, glitz.
Leather, camp. Plastic, neon. There's nothing not to love about Eurovision.
All right, so that's two great options. Eurovision, broadcast for the first time in the United States, and the Ali Wong comedy special on Netflix.
Right, that should take up most of your weekend.
Oh, I'm happy now.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, whose goal is a world without blood cancers, funding research for new treatments and targeted approaches to therapy. Learn more at lls.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
Whoa.
stewardess, I speak jive.
Animal movies. Ha ha, yes indeed. No Friday the 13th would be complete unless we talked to Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. In fact, no Friday at all would be complete because we do Friday movies then. Rafer, welcome.
Hi, John.
So what you got for us? Money Monster is the big release. I love the trailers. It's a Jodie Foster directed movie. Clooney's in it.
You got delivery?
Don't move.
This is a union thing.
Oh, Jesus! Oh, Jesus! Cut Jesus! Turn those cameras back on! Whoever's in there, turn those cameras back on right now!
I can't. Once I turn them off...
You're lying!
In his head! Turn those cameras on, Patty! Turn them on!
And I swear to God, I'm pulling this trigger.
Patty.
One!
Patty, what do you want me to do?
Turn them off, Patty!
Two!
What do you want me to do?
Put it up!
Money Monster doesn't seem like a serious title for a movie. Is this a serious movie?
I think it wants to be kind of a topical popcorn thriller. That's George Clooney playing Lee Gates, who's basically Jim Cramer. He's got the host. He's a show host, financial show host. And he's the guy who enters the shoot there is a guy named Kyle, played by Jack O'Connell. He's an angry investor who lost everything based on Lee's advice. And he's going to take revenge and he wants to find out where his money went. So this is basically a rematch of Jon Stewart versus Jim Cramer from 2009.
Oh, right.
Except now you've got a guy with a gun and a bomb.
Okay, well, that's what that needed, actually. Right. I hear Julia Roberts in the background, too.
That's right. She plays the producer, Patty, his loyal producer, who sticks by him even as the guy comes in waving his gun. I think the movie wants to say something about Wall Street and the system and the 99%, but I think just because you throw those terms around and say things like, you know, complicit media and government bailout doesn't mean you're actually addressing the problem. And I think when you get right down to it, it's really just a rudimentary thriller with all the usual kind of simple plot, some slow-moving cops, you know, implausible coincidences and all that stuff. It's kind of too bad because it's a great premise and it does hold you for the first few minutes and then it kind of gets a little bit dumber and dumber as it goes on.
And Kramer's supposed to be the hero in this movie?
I think that's one of the problems with the film is it kind of lets the Kramer character off the hook and it kind of lets Wall Street off the hook. It doesn't really get into the issues at all. It just kind of boils down into your typical kind of B-grade, you know, white-collar criminal fraud kind of stuff, the guy in the Learjet, all that stuff. It just doesn't really say what you want it to, even for just kind of a summer thriller.
It's been in just a few theaters up until now, but it's expanding. The Meddler, Susan Sarandon, kind of a favorite of yours. Let's listen to a clip.
I don't want her to hurt herself or anything. I mean, does she talk to you about that? I'm not saying that I want to know what she says. I'm just saying that if she talks to you about stuff, I hope she talks to you about that stuff and that you talk to her about that stuff and that you make sure she doesn't hurt herself or anything. And, you know, maybe also tell her to stop smoking so much grass. I know she's in some stage of grief or something.
And what about you?
What about me?
I love her. I fear this movie isn't as great as that clip, but what do you think?
You know, that's Susan Sarandon. She's playing the meddler. She's one of these over-involved mothers. So over-involved, in fact, that that scene is her talking to her daughter's therapist and trying to extract information. One of the better scenes in the film. It actually works really well. It's semi-autobiographical. The filmmaker's name is Laureen Scafaria. Rose Byrne, who plays the daughter, is named Laurie. And the character of Susan Sarandon is based on the filmmaker's actual mother. And I think there's so much frustration and also love that kind of pours out of this movie for that character, and you've got Susan Sarandon in the role, that it's really hard to resist. It's actually a really sweet, funny movie, great cast. J.K. Simmons is in it. He plays Sarandon's love interest, and they're wonderful together. And so
it's like the mom wants to move in with the daughter sort of idea, right?
Yeah, she basically does. She's actually, you know, transplanted herself to Los Angeles following her daughter so that she can kind of help her, quote unquote, with her, you know, career as a television writer. But it's actually a really wonderful, very sweet movie.
All right. Well, that's a good suggestion. The Meddler going from a small release to wide release with Susan Sarandon, Rose Byrne, and J.K. Simmons, and Money Monster with Clooney, Julia Roberts, and Jamie Linden writing that script. Hey, Rafer, have a great weekend. And it's Friday the 13th. You be careful out there.
I will. No ladders. I'll walk under no ladders, John.
What if living creatures in your city were part of the first responder team in dealing with urban problems? Hey, what about police dogs? They exist. There could be detective cats or surveillance birds, fertilizer worms. I guess we already know about the helpful worms. But here is a real story about a city, Portland, Oregon, that was baffled about finding elevated levels of cadmium, a heavy metal that can cause cancer. Where was it coming from? This is a heroic first responder story that you're not going to forget, because the hero in this case is a species of tree moss. Cassandra Profita from member station OPB in Portland takes us there.
Forest Service researcher Sarah Javon barely has to walk two blocks from her office in downtown Portland to find a shaggy patch of dark green tree moss. It grows all over the city.
You can even just see it from here, these trees. You can see the big, dark blotches. Basically, that's the moss. You can see it across the street, all these trees on the street here.
Javon is a lichenologist. That is, she studies moss and lichen.
So for a sample, probably you'd need maybe, you know, a couple handfuls. And you take it in the lab and you trim it up a little bit. There's often bark and dirt and whatnot.
To test it for pollutants, scientists grind up the moss, liquefy it, and run it through a machine that measures contaminants. Because moss gets all of its nutrients from the atmosphere, it's a natural air pollution monitor, as Forest Service economist Jeff Donovan found out.
And until we got into this, I was kind of assumed that we knew what was in our air, but we actually know very little.
Donovan and Javon wanted to see if moss testing could help regulators track down the source of the city's extra cadmium pollution. Together, the researchers gathered more than 300 moss samples across the city. Then, they reviewed the results.
We go and we look at the heavy metal data, you know, we open up the data sheet. But then we see these two big hotspots, I mean, really big hotspots. So one in southeast Portland and one in north Portland.
They overlaid the cadmium hotspots with a map of known sources of cadmium pollution, expecting them to match up.
And they didn't at all. And that's where the mystery started.
So where was the cadmium coming from? As they searched for other possible sources, they made a startling discovery. The levels of cadmium in the moss samples clearly pointed to the culprits. The two hotspots were right around two companies that make artistic stained glass.
We're looking at these things thinking, wow, we didn't see this one coming. I mean, most people don't think stained glass manufacturers as sort of evil polluters. You know, you don't think of that at all. It was surprising, certainly.
Stained glass makers use cadmium to make their red, orange, and yellow colors. But they aren't required to use pollution controls or test their emissions. So regulators didn't know how much cadmium they were releasing. The levels were particularly alarming around bullseye glass. There, the moss also revealed a hotspot for arsenic, another metal used in glassmaking.
I was furious. I was honestly so mad.
Sarah Livingstone lives a few blocks from Bullseye. Weeks before officials announced the hazardous hotspots, she had rushed to the ER, unable to breathe. She was diagnosed with pneumonia and pleural effusion. She didn't have a reason to blame air pollution until she heard the news.
And, you know, my understanding is that both arsenic and cadmium can really wreak havoc on the lungs, especially cadmium.
Based on the moss tests, state officials put an air monitor near Bullseye. The levels of cadmium and arsenic they found were unprecedented, high enough to cause cancer. When Livingstone's lung problems hadn't cleared up, her doctor started testing for lung cancer. She says she feels betrayed by officials who admit they didn't know what was in the air in her neighborhood.
If the Forest Service would not have presented them with the tree moss study, would we even know about it now? No.
Based on the moss findings, Oregon officials are rewriting state air pollution rules, two Portland glassmakers will be required to install pollution controls, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is investigating stained glass companies across the country. But the whole ordeal has left many wondering what other toxic air pollution regulators are missing. Why aren't we taking more moss samples?
They're really showing us things that we haven't been able to detect before.
Vivek Shandis is an urban planning professor at Portland State University. He says because air testing is so expensive, it's normal for regulators to test just one location per city.
We only know really at a very general level across the metropolitan region what the air quality is like. We're missing a lot, though I would have to add, I'm not surprised.
Shandis hopes more moss testing can fill in the gaps in what we know about air pollution. It costs $150,000 a year to run a monitor that can only test the air in one place. The Forest Service spent $20,000 on moss sampling to test the air across the city. Portland State University is now planning to buy the machine it needs to do its own moss testing.
It's inexpensive. It's relatively easy to get. Why aren't we turning over every stone and looking under every moss carpet?
We're not quite at the point where we can just test moss instead of putting up air monitors. Javon and Donovan with the Forest Service say they still need to do more research to convert moss test results directly into air quality measurements. But they say that's the dream. Meanwhile, they're planning a trip to Cincinnati, where doctors are finding children with elevated mercury and cadmium in their blood. No one knows where the metals are coming from, but the city's moss could offer some clues. For The Takeaway, I'm Cassandra Profita, member station OPB.
Cassandra's report is part of a series exploring urban resilience and how we can make our communities stronger. It's a collaboration between member stations KPBS in San Diego, OPB in Portland, WDET in Detroit, and KUT Austin. Actor Colin Farrell has been in some dicey situations on screen where he's got to make a decision in his career. But here's a new one.
I understand this discussion is a little unpleasant for you, but it is my duty to prepare you psychologically for all possible outcomes. Now, have you thought of what animal you'd like to be if you end up alone?
Yes, a lobster.
Why a lobster?
Because lobsters live for over 100 years, are blue-blooded like aristocrats, and stay fertile all their lives. I also like the sea very much. I water ski and swim quite well since I was a teenager.
I must congratulate you. The first thing most people think of is a dog.
In the new movie Lobster, that's about the first and last reference to the crustacean you will see, Farrell has to pick an animal because in a world where people are required to reproduce, you've got to find a romantic partner in 45 days or else you get turned into the animal of your own choosing. The film won the jury prize at Cannes and opens today. Trapped in this world, director Yorgos Lanthimos wants his characters to explore new forms of desperation, longing, and eventually true love. Colin Farrell stars as David, John C. Reilly as his friend, and Rachel Weisz as the woman who will force David to make a choice. Farrell told me he embraced the insanity of this world quite naturally.
David is completely in acceptance and accordance with his environment, even if the environment is in agitation or even if things aren't going his way. I don't want to say he's somnambulistic, but he is towing the party line, and it's a very particular system that David and the rest of the cast of characters in this film live within and beneath. I mean, I loved the situation and the dynamic of the world that was created and the logic of the world, as outlandish as the rules of this world that the characters inhabit in the lobster seems as outlandish. There was a perfect kind of logic to it, every single bit of it. So while it felt absurd at times in reading it, by the time we got to doing it, it felt like we were just, you know, enmeshed in the status quo of the story. And I had seen Yorks's work. I had seen Dogtooth and I had seen Alps. So I knew that he was a director and a writer who kind of operates beyond the pale.
Do you feel this is a redemption of romance in the end?
Romance doesn't want to be redeemed. romance is beyond redemption. It exists in some kind of flightier place than where redemption resides. I think it's a story about, you know, I don't know what it's about, but one of the things that you could observe is that even under the stricture of this world and even as oppressive as this kind of social, almost political, almost religious system is that everyone lives within, that love does find a way, you know, as awkward as that love may be presented in this film between myself and Rachel's character.
So Yorgos, you're just a softie. This is a smushy film.
Yeah, I always saw it as a very romantic film, a romantic comedy even.
I mean, in a way, this is a metaphor for being single in that, you know, you get divorced and if you can't find somebody, you do recede into this set of personality characteristics that could almost be described as a kind of animal.
Mm-hmm. I mean, socially, they're, you know, I have friends who I have heard stories directly of friends of mine who have been kind of at various stages, and it's not too common, but a couple of times through the years who have been stigmatized by being single, that were in a kind of a social dynamic that involved a heavy amount of couples sharing experiences, going on holidays, having dinners and all that, and then there was a breakup, and this is the person I heard it from, and there was a kind of a stigmatization there, and they were excluded from further experiences. And there's also a personal stigma that we put on ourselves and a pressure that if we're not sharing our lives with somebody at times that there's something wrong with us or that we're missing out on, you know, a really important aspect of the human experience. And while that may be true, and while this film isn't particularly trying to poke holes, I don't feel, at anything or judge anything, it's just presenting a lot of different factors of what the human and the communal experience is in a variety of our communities around the world. Those kind of suspicions or those kind of social bents are given a very particular structure in the form of, yes, either find a partner or we will turn you into an animal.
Yorgos, are the animals a form of sequester?
Well, the animals for us, it started, you know, as just trying to find relatively positive punishment for people that were single and never made it, to find someone. You know, then it becomes many other different things for people. And yeah, it just depends how you see it.
How did the world get to be this way, Yorgos, in your imagination?
I think, you know, we never came up with the world as it is. It was just a process trying to figure out, you know, what kind of structure would help us explore the themes that we wanted to explore. You know, so starting from an idea, you know, what would happen if, you know, single people were taken somewhere to find a mate and you were not allowed to walk around free in our society. Then, you know, we had to fill in the details of what that world would be, discover the rules, and so on.
You know, what I love about this film is dystopian settings in the movies have become so banal that you expect that there's going to be some sort of dystopian setting, that when we get to your premise, it just seems so fresh that it's like, oh, that's the real dystopia.
That's why we're trying to avoid, you know, such characterizations, although I guess in the beginning it was us who first called it a dystopian film. But I think, yeah, it's not really a dystopian film. It's a world very much like our own.
Which is dystopian in itself.
Yeah.
We're in dystopia, kids.
And it has a pretense of good intentions, and the world tries to present whatever is happening there in a positive light. So that's why it's quite different from the cliche dystopian world that we are aware of.
Do extreme situations that are Kafkaesque like this, you know, the turn into a bug when you wake up in the morning kind of idea that is sort of floating around in this film, Colin, are they fun to do as an actor? The more outlandish and ridiculous it is it more fun or more challenging or both?
I don't think that the separation from reality is as experienced as an actor as it is as a viewer. You know, I think by the time it gets to the viewer, there's ideally a complete sense of this world is presented, and whatever absurdity or ridiculousness may be in there in a film like The Lobster or in a story like Metamorphosis, the audience or the reader get to participate in that. But as the creator, as the writer director, I mean, Yorgos can speak for himself, but as one of the actors, you know, you see behind the veil and it becomes a practical experience. But having said that, there were moments in this film that were so outlandishly and also kind of sweetly odd, whether it was kissing Rachel in front of Lea Seydoux's character's parents as they were playing the guitar that time, or kicking the little girl in the shin that time to prove that I didn't care, or whatever it may be, that there was a couple of times that I found the oddness of it incredibly affecting, aka I laughed out loud and broke characters, they say, and all that jazz. But no, the experience of it was, I mean, I just fell in love with the world. I really did. And I fell in love with, as violent as it is and as oppressive an experience the majority of the characters are having, I just fell in love with what I think is a kind of unusual and inherent sweetness that we arrive at by the end of the film.
It sounds like it made you feel more human.
Made me feel less like a lobster, yes.
Like that. Yorgos and Colin, thank you so much.
Thanks a million, man.
Thank you.
Actor Colin Farrell portrays David in The Lobster, written and directed by Yorgos Lanthimos. The film is out today. Here's something to take with you. The heads of state of five Nordic countries will dine at the White House tonight. One issue that might come up is The Lobster. Sweden wants to ban the Homaris americanus, the specific native to the northeastern United States, from European waters because it fears the American lobster is an invasive species threatening to wipe out the Nordic lobster variety. An EU panel will rule on the potential ban next month, but in the meantime, the White House is serving a foraged meal, baby radishes with Vermont butter, all served on pieces of wood. Norwegian wood. Good. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.